He was confined to a nursing home, and we all knew that it would not be long. And my dad knew that it would not be long before he passed from this life into the next. And he was ready for that. That held no fear for him at all. But I treasure a night when my dad said, "Don, let's go for a walk," which meant he was going to get into his wheelchair and I was going to push him around for a while. And I was glad to do it. I was glad to do it. And as we walked along, my dad shared some thoughts with me about things that were important. And I have treasured those thoughts. And the first thing that he said is, "Don, I know I'm not long for this world, but I know that I'm going to see Jesus. And above all else, Don, I pray that you would walk with Jesus Christ." What a great thing for him to say. And then he said, "And Don, you have a special family. Jane and your kids are all precious souls. Love them." I hope that in some measure I have lived up to the legacy that my father left for me. I share that because there's a question that arises over the assembly. Never mind that. Over the assembly of these last chapters of 2 Samuel. It is a uniquely put together bit of literature. I have mentioned last week, and I'd offer in your bulletins, which by the way, you folks should be in a habit of getting, but this is ordered in such a way that it is a traditional Hebrew chiasm. The beginning in chapter 21 and ending with chapter 24, it deals with three specific bits of information that we need to deal with. The first is that the problem in David's kingdom was sin and the need for atonement to be made for it. And so 21, 1 through 14, and then 24, 1 through 25, deal with the necessity of atonement for sin to offset God's wrath against sin. God has not changed. He is the same yesterday, today, and forever. And if sin bothered him in the days of David, it bothers him today. And people that want to just shrug it off are making a terrible mistake. Sin needs to be dealt with, but the glory of Christian theology, the glory of the Scriptures, the glory of the work of God is that sin has been dealt with by Jesus Christ. This is not some shallow thing for us to think about. Your sin and mine was dealt with on the cross. Atonement is a marvelous, rich word. But there will come times in your life that after atonement is made for sin, God is going to ask you to do things that are absolutely beyond you. I've been reflecting now, because next year will make 40 years in pastoral ministry for me, which ought to make you think, yeah, he's getting old. If I had known some of the things that God was going to ask of me in pastoral ministry, I might have lived out what I had hoped, what I wrote down when I was graduating from high school. As far as what I wanted to do, I wrote down, I said, I want to either be a nuclear physicist or a football coach. I wasn't being entirely facetious, but the principal caught it, and he said, we need to reword this. God drew me into ministry. He first drew me to salvation, and then to ministry. And he has asked some difficult things. And he's not just asking difficult things of me, he's asking difficult things of all his people. And the things that are worth doing at all are things you cannot do alone. But that God will infuse you with strength to make it possible that they be done. God is calling us to aspire to great things, just like he called David to be king of Israel. David has spent most of his first years as king of Israel at war. To our knowledge, David never initiates a single fight, but they come to him. And he's got to respond to them, and he does. One of the first occasions that you remember is when in his youth, there was a giant that faced the armies of Saul, and David displayed strength that was way beyond a young boy when he slayed Goliath. Do you remember what he said? Well, if you don't, I'll say it. I'll read it. In 1 Samuel 17, the Lord, who delivered me from the paw of the lion and from the paw of the bear, will deliver me from the hand of this Philistine. And Saul said to David, go, and the Lord be with you. Then a bit later, David said to the Philistine, you come to me with sword and with a spear and with a javelin, but I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied. This day the Lord will deliver you into my hand, and I will strike you down and cut off your head. And I will give the dead bodies of the host to the Philistines this day, to the birds of the air, and to the wild beasts of the earth, that all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel. And that all this assembly may know that the Lord saves not with sword and spear, for the battle is the Lord's, and he will give you into our hand. David knows he can't take on Goliath by himself, and he doesn't even allow that the armies of Israel can take on the armies of the Philistines. But he is awesomely confident that the Lord of the armies of the Israelites and the Lord who has been with David can defeat them. And he does. Such a cheeky thing for a young boy to say. But at the end of his life, when he might have been asking Solomon, let's go for a walk, there was war again, 2 Samuel 21, between the Philistines and Israel. And David went down together with his servants, and they fought against the Philistines, and David grew weary because Because by this point, David's getting older. I understand a little bit about getting older and getting weary. Some of you know that all too well. The things that I used to be able to do all day long come harder. David grew weary. And then we get a list of names that if I butcher one of them, please don't hold it against me. But Ishbi-benob, one of the descendants of the giants, whose spear weighed 300 shekels of bronze and who was armed with a new sword, thought to kill David. But this time David is not the respondent. This time, another man, Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, came to his aid and attacked the Philistine and killed him. Then David's men swore to him, "You shall no longer go out to us in battle, lest you quench the lamp of Israel." And after this, there was again war with the Philistines at Gob. The Sibekai, the Hushathite, struck down Saph, who was one of the descendants of the giants. For those of you who weren't here when we talked about Goliath, the giants that they're talking about are not men of myth. They're men who were real giants. Goliath is described as someone who stood nearly 10 feet tall. And this weaver's beam spear that they talk about, a spear was always about 2 or 3 feet taller than the wielder of the spear. So we're going to make a spear that's 12 or 13 feet tall. And it was a 3-inch round shaft on it. I could get my hand about a third of the way around this thing. I couldn't pick it up. It weighs, the head of it weighs 300 shekels, about 15 pounds. Between the shaft and the head of the spear, if I drew back to throw this as hard as I could, it will whoomp, just like that. But this guy can wield it. He can use it. It's not beyond him to hurl it. I remember a Far Side cartoon in which there are these soldiers at some western fort, and embedded into the wall of the fortress is this huge arrow. And the one guy's reporting to the captain. He said, "Well, the good news is that we know there's only one of them." But he's big. David defeats these people along with his allies. The people that are mentioned here, David defeats them, and the strength of David would be judged by the giants that are defeated. And it would be judged by the warriors that are enlisted in his call. There are people that rise up in David's army, like Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, or Jonathan, son of Shimei, David's brother. Those are the warriors who are enlisted in his call. Let me read a report of one of these encounters, because you might think that it's fanciful stuff, but we have no reason to believe that it's not absolutely true. The Lord is causing someone, we don't know who, to write these words down, because it's sure not Samuel. Because Samuel died early on in what we know as 2 Samuel. It might be Gad. There's any number of people that could have been the author of this section, but he tells us this story. These are the names. This is in chapter 23, verse 8. These are the names of the mighty men whom David had: Joshub, Bash of Beth, a Trachimite. He was chief of the three. He wielded his spear against 800 whom he killed at one time. And next to him among the three mighty men was Eleazar, the son of Dodo, son of Ahoa. He was with David when they defied the Philistines who were gathered there for battle, and the men of Israel withdrew. He rose and struck down the Philistines until his hand was weary and his hand clung to the sword. And the Lord brought about a great victory that day, and the men returned after him only to strip the slain. And next to him was Shammah, the son of Agee the Heratite. The Philistines gathered together at Lehi, where there was a plot of ground full of lentils, and the men fled from the Philistines. But he took his stand in the midst of the plot and defended it and struck down the Philistines, and the Lord worked a great victory. These are known in the annals as the three mighty men of David. And then it gives a description of 30 more mighty men. But now that strength in David is fading. So there's another memory that I have of my father. Invariably, we had grown up arm wrestling. And by arm wrestling, I mean my dad would take my hand and plop it on the table. And we continued that every time I'd come home from college. And I was starting to think maybe I was growing up a little bit. And we'd go arm wrestle, and my dad would still just plop it on the table. But I remember a day when I came home from college and we arm wrestled, and I realized I could beat him because his strength was fading. He had used it up. Farming, husbanding, parenting, working for the Lord, he had used it up. My dad still won that one because I was in no way going to beat him. But we didn't arm wrestle again after that, because I wouldn't have embarrassed my dad by winning that for anything. But David's strength is fading. But the great accomplishments still stood. These people, David and the men who were with him, they're legendary. And their exploits are fabulous. So fabulous that some people question whether or not such things could happen. 800 men at one time, people say, couldn't be. Well, with God, things are certainly possible. But I would give you some exploits in the annals of history that might say that 800 at one time is pretty impressive, but it could happen. So let me just remind you of Horatius at the bridge when the Etruscans were advancing on the Tiber River against Rome back in the day before it was a legendary empire, and Horatius and two others with him on side by side stood to defend the bridge at the Tiber River while the rest of the Roman people chopped it down so the Etruscans couldn't get across. And the description of the Etruscan army is in the thousands. And Horatius and his two fellows stood and held them off until the bridge could be torn down. And just before it fell, Horatius said to his two friends, "Get across the bridge and be saved." And he stood there alone until he heard the bridge crash behind him. And then he turned to make his way to the Tiber River, and as he turned, he could see his house across the way. And in full armor, he plunged into the Tiber River, having spent himself in fighting and having had his eye put out by a spear. He plunged into the Tiber River in full armor, and he sank. And everybody thought Horatius had met his end, until lo and behold, he came back to the top. And in his armor, he swam the width of the Tiber River and he made it over to the other side. And when he got out on the bank, there was cheering on the Roman side and on the Etruscan side for the exploits of Horatius. We have no reason to think this is a mythic story. But in case you want to dismiss that, I would take you to the 300 Spartans at Thermopylae against tens of thousands who are advancing on Sparta. Or if you want to think that's just a movie, I would take you to the 189 Swiss guardsmen who stood and defended St. Peter's Basilica against the Huns and kept them away. Or if you think that's just legend, I would take you to the Royal Engineer at Rorke's Drift, who were opposed by thousands of Zulus. And they weren't even trained soldiers. They were engineers who were supposed to build things. And they defended Rorke's Drift. Or I would take you to the 20th Maine and Chamberlain guiding those people on the far hook of Little Round Top in Gettysburg, who fought off charges from the 4th Alabama over and over and over again until they were out of ammunition. And the 4th Alabama came up again. And Chamberlain ordered the 20th Maine to fix bayonets and charge. Or I would take you to three relatively small naval vessels in Leyte Gulf during World War II who stood against what was described as the main body of the Japanese Navy. Three ships, not even big ships. They weren't there to fight a war. They were there to handle resupply of the people who were fighting it. But Taffy 3 stood against the main body of the Japanese Navy and held them back long enough that the Japanese decided to go a different way. Chester Nimitz, who was the admiral of the Navy, said it was nothing less than divine intervention. Or if you want to get individual about it, how about Audie Murphy at the Colmar Pocket in World War II, who took a 50 caliber machine gun and sat up on top of a burning tank and for 2 hours kept an entire German division at bay. The most decorated soldier of World War II. Don't tell me things like what are described here by these mighty men of David can't be accomplished. Yes, they are legendary exploits, but they are not the real strength of David. And if you think that you need that kind of strength like we've heard described to do the things God calls you to do, you're mistaken. Because the same strength that helped David is available to you and I. David, in the passage that we had read for us over and over again, says that the Lord was his strength. The Lord helped him in battle. The Lord allowed him to scale a wall. The Lord allowed him, and over, Ray was a little surprised that I asked him to read the whole passage. But if you were paying attention, you would have heard him recite time after time after time after time that the Lord was his strength and his salvation. Yes, we've got mighty men that David is served by, but he knows full well that it is the Lord that gave victory. It is the Lord. It is the legacy of these things that should inspire us to say, when God calls us to a task, I can't, but he can. I can't, but he can. And then we should endeavor to do great things. You would say, well, where's the legacy within Christianity that would inspire me to say I should do great things for Jesus Christ? Well, let me give you a few. Leo, walking out of Rome when Attila the Hun is ready to sack the city, nothing has stood in the way of Attila. And all of the civil magistrates of Rome had fled. Leo was the pastor of the Roman church. And he got dressed up in his best outfit. And he marched out all by himself to meet Attila the Hun. You think that's nervy? And it worked. Because Leo believed in what God could do. It worked. Or how about Martin Luther? Who is leading a reformation endeavor to change the way we think about theology and practice it, who is called on the carpet by leadership that is noted for killing people who act like this. And they take his writings and they say, are these yours? And he says, yes. And he said, do you believe them? And he said, yes. And he said, will you recant? And if you're familiar with the Reformation story, you know Luther's response. Here stand I. I can do no less. And the Reformation is born. Or William Carey, known as the father of modern missions, who led a work to China and India over his life, but he's most noted for his work in China, who was told over and over and over again that there was no use in him going anywhere. He was told by leadership, if God wants to save those people, he will do it without your help. And Carey said, but the scriptures call us to go and tell. And he went and he told. Or how about a little lady known as Harriet Beecher Stowe? She's the author of the book that Abraham Lincoln said spawned the Civil War, Uncle Tom's Cabin. If you haven't read that book, you really should. But it was her book more than any other that in the annals of the history turned the tide of the United States from a slave-tolerating people to a people who would not. Those are names that we know. How about this name, which I can't give you, but the Lord knows. This is one of my favorite characters in all of Christian history. There was a day when a shoe salesman was walking by a church. And the guy standing to open and close doors, he was an usher. He invited him to come in. And D.L. Moody said, okay. And the history of evangelicalism is changed forever by the message that was shared that day because an usher opened the door to him. Don't ever think that the small things that you do out here aren't huge things in the annals of the kingdom of God. Don't ever think that if you're listening to verses of children at Awana, that's a small thing. Whatever it is, if you're called to do a simple thing, it can be used for great things by God. And the legacy of David's here ought to teach us that God is doing great things in your life, in your home, in your work, in your school, wherever it is that you go. When you go as an ambassador of Jesus Christ into this world, God is doing something amazing. This is why I tell you, and I have to challenge myself with it, I wake up every day, almost every day, I don't want you to think I'm better than I am, but almost every day, I wake up and I pray, Lord, if you give me an opportunity today, I will speak a good word for Jesus Christ. And I know some of you are very faithful at that. I know you are. Keep it up. I know that as you live with your spouse or your children or your families, your teachers, your co-workers, I know it can be a daunting thing to speak up for Jesus Christ, but that's the call that we're on. And it's a call that's delivered by the greatest stand that was ever made in all of history. The 300 Spartans are tinker toys compared to this. David's mighty men, they're wimpy rag dolls compared to this. It is when Jesus stood before Pilate and received the sentence of death, and then he carried his cross as far as he could up the hill, and then he let them nail him to a cross and drop it into the ground. And as he was dying, cared for his mother, cared for a thief that's on the cross next to him, cared for all the people who were killing him by saying, "Forgive them because they don't know what they're doing." It stands awesomely before us. The cross. Oh, the cross. And what the cross does for us. It's awesome. And I don't think we should use the word awesome casually. Sunrises can be really beautiful. And they can inspire us with a little bit of sense of awe. Mountains and oceans and small things and huge things can expand us. But there is nothing so expansive as the cross of Christ and the tomb that opened 3 days later. You have that legacy to hang on to. You see, I believe these last chapters of 2 Samuel are written for Solomon and then the others who will come after. Because David wants them to know that the task that they're being given is more than they can handle. But the God who is giving it to them can do all things. You're given a great task. We're called to go into all the world and make disciples of Jesus Christ. It's an awesome challenge, and I use the word right. And you're part of it. I know we just sent Steve over to Kenya, and I'm glad you're back. But you were part of that. You're part of the gospel witness. You can't do it. But Jesus can. So let's get busy. Heavenly Father, open our eyes to opportunities. Let us see the times that you say to us, "Now this is your task." And inspire us to do those things. Things that we might look at and say, it's too much for me. But we rely on you. We rely on you. And you can do all things that you call us to endeavor. Amen.